I hate to say this, but like I still feel as if this is brought on a lot by the fact that you read that book. So don't read books, kids.
Oh my God, read all of the books. Don't listen to him.
Hey there, I'm Jordan.
And I'm Nick.
We're just two regular guys who love talking about film.
And now we'd like to talk to you.
We decided to break down our discussions into three parts.
Because everyone loves a gimmick.
We discuss our expectations for a film before we watch it.
That's take one.
We give our immediate thoughts following the film.
That's take two.
And finally, we research the film at length to prepare for an informed and in-depth discussion.
And that's take three. So if you love film even half as much as we do, join in on the conversation.
This is take three, a movie podcast.
Take one.
Hello, America. It's what? You look like you're about to say something.
Yes.
What were you going
to
say?
No, I was going to say that this is Nick and Jordan, and we're back.
They know that.
Oh, I guess, yeah, if you clicked it.
I literally finished the book yesterday, 24 hours ago. Loved it. And I have not seen the movie all the way through, and I feel like my expectations are maybe a little bit low for this movie. I know it's like a national favorite.
Yeah, this is going to make sense in a second, but we are so excited to watch this movie that we're about to tell you about. Well, you guys know it. You clicked on the damn thing.
They know it.
Yeah, it's The Shining, but we are so excited. We almost like started watching the movie with that recording.
We got it all set up and we were about to press play. And I was like, wait, we need to record the sound for this. No, I'm very eager to start it.
But he's a book reader. I've not read this book. I tried.
Admittedly, I'm one of those people that's like, I got to read the book first. I'm nervous for this movie because I don't think it's going to hold up. I truly don't.
So I've seen this movie, and what I know about it is that it's very different from the book, apparently. Yeah. It's very famous for being different from the book in a lot of important ways. So we shall see. We're going to talk about this, and we're also going to, I guess, talk about how it relates to the book, right? I mean, yeah.
I'm good. Prepare yourself because I love movie adaptations of books. So this is just the first, I guess.
Is it? Have we not done another?
I don't think so.
Okay, so hold on. Shape of Water, Pulp Fiction.
Solo.
No, none of these are books. So this is your first book to movie adaptation that we've... No, you guys don't give a fuck. Let's watch the movie.
Take two.
Well, this was fun to watch.
Was it?
I think the issue is that at the end of the day, I was hoping you would like this movie. I really like this movie.
I think I was hoping for the same.
Yeah. Well, of course, you always want to go into a movie, you know, hoping for the best.
I am so let down. I'm confused. I'm frustrated. I don't get it. I'm very eager to get into take three and to watch Room 237, which for those of you who don't know is a documentary, I guess.
It's a documentary about, it's really hard to describe, but what I would say is that it's a documentary about some of the conspiracy theories and people try to dig in deeper to The Shining and make sense of it. And they have some really interesting and sometimes really batshit crazy theories. And I really think that it's an interesting watch. So that's what we're going to watch before we do take three. Okay. But specifically on this movie, I love it. I think I just can always appreciate the cinematography. I love the storyline of it. I think in this watch, maybe just being pointed out by you, I think maybe the acting didn't feel as natural as I wanted it to. Maybe I remember it feeling more natural.
And I feel like I'm going to come off like such a snob. I'm trying my best to pull the book away from it. And when I do that, it almost seems even worse. And I'm trying to understand that it is maybe a little dated, but...
Well, okay, first, at the end of the day, you have every right to dislike or like any movie you want to, right? This movie, however, is pretty, you know, praised.
That's my point, is that like I know there's a huge fan base around this movie, and I feel like I'm going to piss a lot of people off. But
what I can say is that I've never talked to anyone about this movie that has read the book. You're the first person I've ever talked to about it. My point in bringing that up is you had an experience with the book, positive or negative, just happened to be positive in this case, and the movie can either live up to it or not. Now, I'm not saying that you shouldn't have read the book or that it clouded your judgment of it, but it would be stupid to say that that's not affecting your...
No, and that's my thing, is that even if I feel like reading the book has enhanced my perception of this movie, because a lot of what isn't defined very clearly in the movie, I understand its intent because I read the book.
Yeah, yeah.
But at the same time, this was just a complete bastardization of that story, in my opinion.
I remember always thinking when I heard the classic Stephen King, that's the adaptation that Stephen King really doesn't like. You know, it was Stanley Kubrick giving sort of a middle finger to his story and using parts of it. But for when those of you who don't know, after Stanley Kubrick finished his film Barry Lyndon, he was looking for stories to adapt, and he saw The Shining, and he liked The Shining, and he got the rights to do The Shining. But even though Stephen King had written a screenplay, Stanley Kubrick did not want to use that screenplay to adapt it. And he didn't even want to collaborate with Stephen King on a new screenplay.
Big mistake.
So Stanley Kubrick said, I'm going to take the bare bones of it and adapt it with a different writer. Her name is Diane Johnson, and him and her changed a lot of things.
A lot of things. Yes. Yeah.
But you know, the changing medium, sometimes you do have to change things.
That I can understand. But a faithful adaptation of The Shining is 100% possible. I know that you can't really get into the minds of characters as well in a movie, but like, there is no reason why he had to strip so much of it away. In the book, there were so many elements that created this universe that were not translated and were not clear in the movie. There was this whole wasp motif. There was not a single wasp in the movie. The boiler had a huge part in the book.
I mean, that's what ended the story, correct?
Yeah, it was the heart. Spoiler alert for those who haven't read The Shining, but it was, the boiler was such an important part of the book. It was something he had to check religiously every day. It was sort of the lifeblood. It was the heart of this monster that was the Overlook Hotel.
It's not in it at all.
It was, going into this movie, I kind of knew the history of Stephen King with the adaptation. Apparently it's not his favorite because Jack is portrayed as someone who is sort of crazy right off the bat, and there's really no evolution or development. He's kind of just right off the bat, just a crazy person.
Yeah.
So I kind of knew that going into it, and I could not agree more. I feel like the story is so flat and so...
Well, I will say that, like, I think it was intentional. Jack Nicholson is an intense performer. I'm trying to think of a movie where he's not a little off in one way or another. I think there are a couple, but I think it's very easy for him to sort of play this intense guy. And instead of going from just this really, you know, good relationship with his wife, a nice father, to really bad, what I think happened in this movie, and it had to have been intentional, it had to have been a thought out change from the story, was to have him be someone who is susceptible to falling under the spell of the Overlook, to someone who is, you know, an addict struggling with alcoholism, someone who goes from not good to bad, but bad to very, 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 very bad, much worse. And that's different. That's fine. But like,
it is different. And I know it's important for me to, I have to separate the book from the movie, but then when I do that, like, it's a flat movie. Like, oh, it's this crazy guy stuck with his wife in this hotel. Of course things are going to go wrong. They illustrate this hotel coming alive and showing the people that were there in the past, and showing the ballroom scene where everyone's there. It kind of dissolves the idea that it's the hotel that's doing this. And then when that happens, it turns into a movie about a crazy man who kills his family.
Well, like, is that exciting? But here's the thing, though. We talked about this. I pointed out this part in the movie. It's the moment when Grady, the caretaker, lets him out of the pantry, that's like the first time where you realize, no, this is not in their heads. This is the Overlook is actually cursed and or haunted. And it's not just Danny and Jack being haunted by these visions in their heads. You know what I mean? They are in some place. Like, sure, Danny has this gift, but they are also in some place that is bad, I guess.
Haunted. Demented, yeah.
I didn't even finish my point earlier. Not because you caught me off, but I just went on one of those tangents like I do. But I had always thought, like, Stanley Kubrick is, you know, is correct, and this is this big celebrated movie, and Stephen King just wanted his story faithfully adapted or whatever. But like, from your perspective, you are saying steadfastly that the book is better.
100%.
That's great. Well, we are advocating for the reading of the book as well. But
oh, absolutely, 100%. Yes.
I want to know specific moments that did not work for you in the film, regardless of the book.
Right. Okay. So the acting was not good. I feel so bad saying this because I feel like I'm gonna really piss off a lot of people, but Shelley Duvall, not the best.
Well, okay. And so she's a very specific type of actress, she's not the greatest actress in the world. I agree.
No. And I'm not even blaming her either, because there were even times when Jack Nicholson, I was a little bit like, oh, this it seems so silly. Sometimes,
like,
and I
hammy, it's like they were hamming it up a little bit.
Yes. Yeah. And it was unnecessary. It kind of made the story comical at points. And I don't think the problem was acting. I think the problem was direction. And I don't understand Stanley Kubrick. I'm willing to learn more. I want to learn more about him, about his style, about why he did the things he did. But it did not work for me. It just completely fell flat.
It's not either of our jobs to make excuses for, you know, a movie, especially a movie that probably at the end of the day doesn't really need anybody to make excuses. It's The Shining. It's very celebrated. But part of me always goes into movies that came out before I was born. I was born in 1992. So anything before that, I just always, like, if there's any sort of cheese or hamminess to it, there is a certain level of like, okay, I have to step back and realize that I've never been alive in that time. I've never been an actor in that period of time. I don't know how they were told to specifically act, but like that is the case for a lot of films. Sometimes when I watch older movies, I'm like, oh, it's the term dated clicks in my mind, not as like, oh, you know, maybe the production value isn't but so great, or the special effects aren't amazing. But sometimes what can make a movie dated or make a movie feel dated is the way that the actors come across.
In relationship to this movie, as it pertains to this movie specifically, like, there is no excuse. Like, I think it was just the direction. Like, I've seen quote-unquote dated movies that I've really enjoyed, and I can set aside certain things about the movie that maybe don't work so well because I can understand that they were made in the past, and you know, this is an evolving art form. I just, for this movie, I didn't see that. Like, I didn't, it just seemed like a poor movie. I think at one point I had even said it felt very much like a high school project, like some.
And then I probably told him that he just called one of the most celebrated directors of all time a high school sophomore.
Right, right. But here's the thing. I want to learn about Stanley Kubrick. I want to know why he's so celebrated. I want to know, like, where I'm wrong. I want to know. I want to understand. That's why I'm very eager for take three.
At the end of the day, I mean, I know a lot about Stanley Kubrick, and I've seen probably most of his films, and I can tell you that he has a very intense way of directing, and the things that are most notable about his movies are the imagery and the tone and the way you feel. I don't necessarily feel like the things that stand out in his films are the performances.
I want to know why he changed the things he did, why he did certain things certain ways, so maybe I can understand the story better. And if I can understand it, maybe I'll hate it less. Like, I'm not looking to love this movie. I'm really not. I'm not here to change my opinion or anything. I feel like I'm ignorant right now because I've only seen one side of the story, and I want to like knock down that ignorance if I can.
I think this 237 thing is definitely going to make you see just how much care and effort was put into this movie.
So I have a question.
Okay.
Regarding this movie and other things, would you agree that, I guess, hype of something creates a bias in the way that people view certain things?
Absolutely.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. So I will say that, like, I knew that this was, you know, a widely celebrated movie before I...
Everyone does. Everyone does. Yeah. Yes, everyone does.
But I will say that it can work against a movie too, because you can go in with like high expectations, you know, and then they don't get met.
True. But at the same time, I think I don't like that as a factor of what makes something good.
No, of course not. Of course not. Everything should stand completely on its own. But like, you know.
Right.
And I think that's... It never will.
I think that's something that I want to explore and really realize for myself if a lot of the hype was just hype or if it was valid. I think that's what I want going into take three, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think that a lot of time a movie being adapted from anything, and nowadays movies are adapted
all the time.
Hollywood is so risk averse now that everything has to be adapted from something, because that's the only way, you know, you can sort of guarantee a fan base. Guarantee. It's like, oh, this book was really popular. Okay, we'll make a movie. And sometimes you can't even guarantee that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
A lot of times you can't, honestly. But I will say that it's good for movies that deserve it. You know, it's good for movies to have a chance when there's hype that builds around a film maybe that's doesn't have the luxury of having a ton of money to advertise, or, you know, maybe it's foreign or something like that. It's certainly a good thing. Like, hype can be great because it makes people see it. Mm-hmm. You're right. It's hard for then people to turn around and be able to form their own decisions completely independent from all of that.
Right. And I think I fight for that. Like, I think that's encouraging. I won't say it's giving me a bias, but it's encouraging me to maybe encourage everyone else to maybe look at things differently.
Yeah.
Or start with this movie and kind of like evaluate if people enjoy this movie because it's actually good or just because everyone else liked it.
Yeah. As one final thing in take two, I think this is one where, probably more than any of the other episodes we've done, you guys should watch this one again. If you haven't watched it recently, watch it again with the perspective that somebody who read this book and has never seen this movie before really didn't get it. And maybe you can maybe see, you know, because like me watching it now, I'm more open to seeing the flaws. You know what I mean? Well, sitting there with you, because I've only ever watched it probably with people that were like, oh, wow, this is The Shining. This is a big deal, you know, but the fresh perspective of like somebody who had never seen it before and is an adult and can form their own articulate opinions on film and you not liking it, that's actually a first of experience for me. So we'll see. We'd love to hear what you guys have to say, and we'll get back to you like in a couple of seconds, because we're just going to do the take three and then you'll hear the clap and all that shit. And then I guess we can
You should leave it out this time, just confuse everyone.
It would confuse me more than anyone else.
The world would descend into chaos. Yeah. No, yeah, we'll be back. I got some studying to do.
My pizza just came.
Oh, nice.
Well, I mean, I ordered a pizza and I'm ready to eat it, so. All right, bye everybody.
Take three. So if I were to ask you what the Mandela effect is, would you know what that means?
Yeah.
For those who don't know.
Oh.
It's basically...
Are we recording?
I mean,
is this like part of it? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Would you care to explain what the Mandela effect is?
So you probably have like a... You prep for this, obviously, because you asked me the question. So you probably have like a good... right?
I mean, yeah, but...
You have a good explanation. I feel like it's that thing where you remember something a certain way and it's in like the public consciousness remembered a certain way. And so that influences, like, people can all as a collective group all think one thing and yeah. it can be wrong. And I don't know how it's in, I don't know why necessarily. I don't know if the Mandela effect speaks on why, but
there's debate that the Mandela effect is proof of multiple parallel realities. I don't know if I buy that. I don't know if it's just another one of those, like, everyone says it wrong, so it just kind of collectively becomes wrong anyway. But an example of this, a popular example, was the Berenstain versus Berenstain bears.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people thought it was Berenstain, but on all the books it says Berenstain. There's the popular Luke, I am your father example. Like, everyone says, oh, Luke, I'm your father. And when really it's the line is, no, I'm your father. It's, I mean,
yeah, that one right there is like a holy shit, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So what I came to realize, this is actually something that I didn't research. I kind of just realized it on my own and watching the movie. I'd always referred to the Grady sisters as twins, and they're not twins.
Yeah.
That was something that I realized watching the movie, because they said in the movie that the daughters were, I think, 8 and 10 years mm-hmm. old. And then through my research, I kept seeing everyone refer to them as the Grady twins. And it's like, holy shit, this is not correct. I don't know if it's true in the book. I don't know if in the book they were actually twins. I don't quite recall. But I just thought that was interesting.
That is really cool. I was like, why is he asking this? This is such a... And then you're like, for those who don't know, I said, oh shit, we are recording, aren't we? Maybe we should talk about The Shining, though.
I'm going to let you go first, though, because I didn't find anything that changed my mind.
That's disheartening. But yeah, okay, I can go. So I will start out by saying that I am surprised at myself for forgetting this fact during our prior conversation. I can guess I'll chalk it up to the fact that I most likely read it while prepping for my horror movie class in college. And this class was once a week from like 7 to 9:45 at night. And can you imagine where I spent the majority of the evening before class each week?
Drinking.
Happy hour. Absolutely. anyway, I remembered through just sort of reading all of this again that the praise and adoration for this film was not immediate. In fact, it had a lot of problems out of the gate.
Yep. So I got that. I read that too.
Yeah. In May of 1980, which is just actually, this is pretty cool. It's just 2 weeks after Friday the 13th. The first Friday the 13th came out.
Oh, interesting.
The Shining was released to some less than favorable reviews. There was criticism over the lack of relatable characters, its slow pace and irrelevancy. Out of Kubrick's final 9 films, the last 9 he ever made in his life, it was the only one not to get at least a nomination from the Oscars or the Golden Globes.
Yeah, I found that too. It received 0 Oscar nominations. This is one of my points. And its most significant piece of contemporary recognition, this is a quote I found online, its most significant piece of contemporary recognition was to earn the filmmaker a nomination for Worst Director at the inaugural Golden Raspberry Awards in 1981.
Yeah, that was my next thing.
Oh, I'm sorry if I stole your thunder. I got excited there. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it not only got Kubrick one, but Shelley Duvall also got nominated for Worst Actress. And that's pretty, okay, wait, hold on. I don't know if everybody knows what the Golden Raspberry Awards are. They're also called the Razzies. They are the anti-Oscars. They celebrate the worst in cinema. A lot of people wind up not showing up, but like every once in a while you'll get like a celebrity to come and sort of admit that, hey, this wasn't a great performance. But like Sandra Bullock has gone up there, Halle Berry. I believe Sandra Bullock won an Oscar for The Blind Side the same year that she won a Razzie for All About Steve. Yeah, so like...
Oh,
it's
no.
Just in good fun. And maybe it was like the next year or something, but it was right around that time. I just remember thinking that was hysterical. Regardless, though, yeah, Duvall and Kubrick were both nominated for them. And I would be remiss not to have mentioned that one of the film's biggest criticisms are the points where it strays from the book's narrative.
Yes.
However, not even a decade later, major film critics and scholars began acknowledging that Kubrick had created something to be studied and revered. The pace and grandeur of the film were not particularly appreciated in horror at the time of its release. It wasn't common back then. but it's definitely been one of those films that audiences and critics have caught up with. Now, I don't normally quote people on here, but I think since we are specifically talking about criticism, I think it's appropriate. When the Blu-ray for this movie came out in 2007, a film critic, Peter Brack, said, and I quote, "Just as the ghostly apparitions of the film's fictional Overlook Hotel would play tricks on the minds of poor Jack Torrance, so too has the passage of time changed the perception of The Shining itself." Many of the same reviewers who lambasted the film for not being scary enough back in 1980 now rank it among the most effective horror films ever made, while audiences who hated the film back then now vividly recall being terrified by the experience. The Shining has somehow risen from the ashes of its own bad press to redefine itself not only as a seminal work of the genre, but perhaps the most stately, artful horror ever made. So, there is hope for you that maybe someday you will look
if I watch it again
positively. Others have praised its use of the Overlook not as just a set, but as a world for us all to inhabit for couple hours. I mean, as we saw in Room 237, the documentary we watched, people have charted maps to essentially provide blueprints of every room in this hotel. Mm-hmm. So for those who are into it and really pay attention to the space and the layout of the building, I personally think it improves the suspense of the chase at the end because you can sort of know where everyone is in the space of the hotel.
No, yeah, that's definitely a good point.
Why, thank you. I also want to talk about some of the influences that The Shining has had on the genre going forward.
Of like horror, like specifically, or?
Yeah, horror genre, thrillers, honestly, cinema in general. So the first one I have is a transition of focus when it comes to how children are portrayed in horror films. In decades prior, movies like The Bad Seed, Village of the Damned, The Exorcist, and The Omen focused on children who were in an evil or antagonistic role. But after Danny and The Shining, the genre seemed to take a turn toward a trend of more empowered children actually fighting against adult evil in an effective way. Like take Child's Play or Nightmare on Elm Street or even like The Goonies. It's all about kids actually being able to stand up to
being the heroes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And Danny's not the bad guy in that story. He actually is able to do some good, you know? So I thought that was a pretty interesting one.
Yeah, for sure.
Another is the cinematography. I can't give this movie all of the credit because movies like Suspiria and Rosemary's Baby also put a huge emphasis on symmetry and color and contrast when composing their shots as well. But nearly every frame of this film could be a painting. And as for the movies it's influenced, honestly, like, pick the most beautiful film you can think of from the past 39 years. I would imagine that The Shining in this era of highbrow, cerebral horror films had an effect on its cinematography.
Can you give me an example?
So the way that I'm looking at this is, like, films that are horror or thriller or genre in whatever way, but that take that extra step to be a little bit more produced, take an active role in making their cinematography a character in the film, and pay great attention to that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because a lot of movies don't do things like that, but the ones that do have great cinematography and that are memorable, I'm thinking of movies that are like The Orphanage, Neon Demon, It Follows, The Witch, The Conjuring. These are movies that have cinematographers that are fantastic at their jobs and realize that it is important that a horror movie can be scary and gory or raw or whatever, but it can also be very well produced in a pretty film.
And artistic, you know? Yeah.
Exactly. Very, very, very artistic and use color and contrast and things like that, which I absolutely love about The Shining.
No, that makes sense. And actually, a few of those that you listed, I really want to do for this podcast in the future.
Like which ones?
Neon Demon, definitely. If you haven't seen that, It's very disturbing and
love Neon Demon.
Very beautiful. What a great movie.
I also wanted to talk about probably my favorite aspect of the movie. I'm not a huge music or sound aficionado, so I'm not even going to pretend that I know how this movie influenced movies in the future of cinema or whatever. But my favorite aspect of The Shining is pretty much everything involving sound, whether that be like the score, the soundtrack, or even just like the sound design for things like the wind howling in the blizzard, or Danny riding his big wheel around the hotel and going from carpet to hardwood floor and then back to carpet, yeah, back to hardwood floor.
That was one of the more, I'll say, profound elements of that film, or decisions, I'll say. Yeah. Like that was really cool. And it was, seems so insignificant, but I will say that was a positive that I picked up on. And liked.
I can't remember whether or not this was in Room 237 or just something I watched independently, but I thought it was really cool. Somebody brought up the fact that he's riding around, and it's not just showing him doing something mundane. It's sort of giving us a layout of this area.
Yeah, yeah.
For you to see, you know, because people are going to be chasing each other around and running around from people later, and we'll have an idea of like where they are in mm-hmm. reference to each other, which I thought was pretty cool. It's like informing your, again, layout of the hotel. Back to the sound though. I feel like the mix of it gives you moments where you feel the loneliness of being in this like giant empty hotel, but then turns around and it's like you can feel like there's like a gnat buzzing in your ear, but there's like this really high sort of noises, like when they're zooming in on characters, and mm-hmm. it's crazy. And then there's like music that feels rightfully from the 20s,
yeah,
that was used from the soundtrack. And then there's like synths that could easily find themselves in a modern day film in 2019. And also, before I sort of end mine, I just wanted to talk about Room 237, because obviously it is a documentary about this film. And my favorite points about this were, first off, I definitely recommend this movie. It's definitely for people who I think like The Shining and are super interested in sort of learning, or at least maybe not learning, but hearing theories that are, in my opinion, some of them are definitely far reaches, but they are all interesting.
Yeah,
and it's definitely cool to see, because I love that type of stuff when people get so into a movie and are like, oh, there's got to be more there. And like in this movie, it's so enigmatic that like, of course, people are going to try to find, you know, mm-hmm. Try to make sense of it.
Yeah.
The first one that they really talk about is that the overall film is a allegory for the genocide of the Native Americans, the fact that the Overlook was built on an Indian burial ground, and there's mm-hmm. there's Indian pictures or Native American pictures all over the hotel.
In the lobby, there's like rugs and designs, and
there's a very particular placement of a brand called Calumet. I don't even know what that wound up, what was in it, but it's basically something in the
pantry.
Yeah. So I think that's a pretty interesting theory, that if you guys ever wanted to look into it, there's a lot more to it than what I just wanted to bring them up, because I think, again, you guys, if anybody cares about these things, they're pretty cool.
I can attest that it certainly opened my eyes to a lot of things. I think it even brought up mention of the Holocaust in some regards. And I think it's certainly a movie that after you watch the documentary, you'll go back and watch the movie and just find something new every single time you watch it, which is cool.
It's very cool. For sure. Yeah. So you're right. There is a section on the Holocaust. There are some pretty dark and depressing ones. I mean, obviously the genocide of the Native Americans is depressing. I think the most interesting one to me was the theory that Stanley Kubrick was instrumental in faking the footage that we saw in 1969 when we landed on the moon.
Yeah.
He's not arguing that we didn't land on the moon, but that
the footage for some that reason we have.
They faked the footage that we had. And it's fascinating. And the idea is that this movie wholly and completely was just Stanley Kubrick trying to, I guess, tell somebody or get it off his chest that he had faked the moon landing in the most cryptic way possible. It's really an interesting, weird little movie. If I can get anybody to try this thing, or if anybody has actually seen this already and wants to talk about it, I would love to. But yeah, that's my little bit. I know you're about to shit all over this movie. I don't have any sort of, we were talking about this before. I can't defend it, but so much, you know what I mean? I think that while we were watching it, your criticisms of it are valid. I like this movie despite them, I guess.
Yeah. And I think that's what I was trying to research and trying to get myself to understand better. But I gotta be honest, I came up with nothing. It was disappointing. It was wholly disappointing. I'm going to start off my section by maybe summarizing a bit of the parts that I liked about the book. So there are spoilers ahead if you haven't read the book, which I highly recommend you do. But basically, it starts off with your typical family. And the way I saw it was, if you kind of think of Adam and Barbara Maitland from Beetlejuice, the dead couple in Beetlejuice, they love each other. It's this beautiful couple that has a child. Yeah, the dad may have a past with alcohol and maybe some abuse, but in the book, he's like, if I remember correctly, he's a couple years sober. There are so many horror elements in the book that strike fear in the reader that were completely overlooked, pun intended. And I feel like it could have added an immense amount of depth to the troubles that the family has to face. Whereas in the movie, I don't want to say it was predictable, but nothing had substance. It was just sort of these things were happening to this family and they had to escape. I don't know. There was no, like in the book, there was a very slow descent into madness. And it's sort of like a terrifying and really heartbreaking transition that Jack has to go through. And in the movie, it's just there from the very beginning. There's really no transition whatsoever. In the book, there's a very heavy theme of dead things coming back into life. It's not really ghosts, but things that are killed and then literally getting up and walking again. And I feel like that is much more terrifying. There is an element of redemption. At the very end, Jack is about to swing. In the movie, it's an axe, but in the book, it's a hammer. He's about to swing the hammer down onto his son. And his son has this moment of, no, dad, it's me. Like, I'm going to try and get you with my shine, and I'm going to try and pull you back into reality. And he's successful. And Jack actually says something like, okay, Danny, like, run, get out of here, before turning the mallet on himself and smashing himself in the face. So, like, Jack has redemption. It's much more clear that it was the hotel that was the enemy and not Jack. And then to finish it all off, there was an explosive, very satisfying, very relieving conclusion. It wasn't a silly frozen face in the snow. So, like, yes, I can understand that this movie is full to the brim with, like, hidden cinematic messages, and I can certainly appreciate the art that goes into crafting a movie. And I can appreciate the very specific decisions that Kubrick made. But at the end of the day, my least favorite part about the movie is that it came at the expense of using a beautiful story. It ripped it to shreds and then transformed it into what? Like, a way to push an agenda or to boast about how you faked a moon landing? Like, I didn't get it. I didn't understand the point of this movie.
Well, I think at the end of the day, like, all of these theories are just theories, and he'll never be able to confirm or deny them. He's been dead, you know, since we were very, very young. But, like, I hate to say this, but, like, I still feel as if this is brought on a lot by the fact that you read that book. So don't read books, kids.
Oh, my God. Read all of the books. Don't listen to him.
No, read, I mean, more. I love books. I think they're great. But, I mean, I have never read this book, and there is a lot to love about this movie. And I feel like the things that you are bringing up not all of them, but I think the ones that you hate the most about this are the fact that it's not the story that you love.
Well, this is just my first point. This is sort of like me sympathizing, or maybe sympathizing is better. I didn't write The Shining, but me sympathizing with Stephen King, basically bastardizing his story. I think there are several other reasons why I disliked this movie. But like I said in take two, it's sort of like, because I know the story, if things aren't really explained very well in the movie, I kind of can fill in the blanks because I've read the book. And it makes me wonder, if I hadn't read the book, would I like it even worse? Because I already kind of believe that the characters are very flat. There's a very flat story here. But I understand its intent, which means I can admire it at least a little bit more, right? Like, does that make sense at all?
Yeah, I guess so. But like, and speaking as someone who's not read the book, I came into it and just accepted that, like, these are the characters. Like, I don't know a ton about them, but it's not really about that. I read somewhere that a quote from Kubrick was just that, this movie was just simply about a man and his family quietly going insane together, or going mad together. I paraphrase that or whatever. But like, essentially, if you don't have that to compare, if you don't have this beautiful, touching, amazing Stephen King story to compare it to, it's a simple, beautiful horror film. And sure, it doesn't have the best acting in it at, you know, it by today's standards, but I don't know. I just don't see it. I don't think that there is any other argument against this movie other than the fact that maybe it's not the best adaptation. But like, clearly, Stanley Kubrick didn't care about that.
No, not at all. And like, I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt and chalking it up to him, in my opinion, just being a shitty artist.
Hey, I have a question really quick. Continue your point. Is it chalking or chalking?
I think chalking. I thought it was chalking.
I always, like, on my notes or whatever, I write chalking, but like, chalking sounds weird. I always say chalking.
No, it's chalk.
Know. Chalk. Yeah. What does that even, like, mean?
Chalk up is an idiom which means to give credit to something or to attain something. It comes from the literal.
C-H-A-L-K.
Yeah.
Huh. Okay, back to our regular scheduled programming.
Oh, you're putting that in?
Yeah.
So, the problems I had with the movie, poor adaptation, obvious. Acting, not great. I really think by any of them. Well, no, by Jack and Wendy specifically. Loved the kid in that movie, and I loved Dick Halloran in that movie. They were my two favorite.
Danny parts. Is so freaking adorable. He's adorable, man. Like, that is a cute-ass little kid.
Yeah. But all in all, each one of those characters are so flat and so one-dimensional that they come across so boring to me. It's so boring.
So you were bored during the film?
Say that again?
You were bored during the film?
I was. The entire time. I was, yes, very bored. I think, like, what came up in my head, there was a clip that I rewatched during my research, and it was the part when Dick Halloran comes up to the group when they're first being introduced to the hotel and shown around. And Dick says to Wendy, "So how are you liking the hotel?" And she goes, "Oh, the hotel is just wonderful. Hi, Danny." It reminded me of The Room.
Oh my God. the way you delivered it, I was like, "Oh, hi, Mark."
Yeah. Yeah. I did not hit her. "Oh, hi, Mark." Like, how this movie is so celebrated, I don't get it. Again, zero Oscar nominations. It was really not successful when it first came out. And it very clearly to me looks like a cult classic that was turned mainstream. But instead of being a cult classic that turned mainstream like The Room, and it was celebrated for how bad it was kind of somehow celebrated in a very positive light.
Again, I mean, the reason you study The Shining is for lessons in suspense and cinematography and film, and because it is again, one of the seminal works in the genre. However, you're right. The acting is definitely leaves you something to be desired.
Right. I just feel like with the arguments that I researched, when I tried to look up what made this movie so successful, I got a lot of responses that talked about, you know, his choices in cinematography. Again, every single frame was very meticulously set up. But I wonder, like, is he the first person to do that? Like, is that why this is so?
No, honestly, at the end of the day, I mean, you can't really credit. There's like 900 movies that come out a year, you know, right. And like you can't really credit any one of them with doing anything that's like specific first, because you really have to go in and have seen all of them.
All of them. All that aside, though, I learned a lot about Kubrick specifically throughout my research, and he seemed like he was really not a nice man. First and foremost being the abuse of Shelley Duvall. Like, method directing when it requires abuse is very much not okay. It's very well known that she had to take off, like, she had to take breaks from working several times throughout the production because she was pushed so hard. She had to take, like, mental breaks. The stairs, when she's on the stairs swinging the baseball bat at Jack, it's in the Guinness Book of World Records for the most takes. She did that take 127 times.
No, I had no idea. And, like, that's terrifying and heartbreaking because, like, I mean, I'm not going to say that there's, like, a correlation or a causation or whatever the word is. But, I mean, if any of you know the state that Shelley Duvall is in now.
My God, it is heartbreaking. Yeah, I'm not going to blame Kubrick for this, but, like, that couldn't have helped. And
yeah, I mean, it's certainly not going to make things easier on her. No. That really sucks.
No, she, like, honestly, it takes a quick YouTube search. That woman, that poor woman, is really struggling at the moment.
I will say, though, that, like, I from everything I know about Stanley Kubrick as well, I agree. He apparently has a genius level IQ, and
yeah,
he a lot of times,
yeah,
some of the smartest people can be some of the meanest, honestly.
Yeah. No, yeah, I get that. And that makes more sense thinking about it now. But I mean, that's still, I don't think that excuses his actions. Not saying that you're trying to excuse it, but.
No, definitely not.
It certainly puts a damper on this movie.
Did it need a damper for you, though? Isn't it already, like, submerged in water?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, I saw this movie. I didn't like it. I wanted to research more about it and maybe change my mind. And then I found out all about this, like, terrible man, and made me like it worse. So
it's like a movie that you didn't like, and then you peeked behind the curtain and
really didn't like what, yeah, I saw.
It's like all this stuff was done, all these takes and all the, like, you know, at the expense of this woman's mental health, and
yeah,
you didn't like it even more.
Yeah. And I mean, if that happened today, that, you mean, Kubrick would be out of work. That's really not okay.
Yeah, I can definitely imagine that 2019 Kubrick would not be as lauded.
Yeah,
for sure.
So, kind of going back to the whole Barbara and Adam Maitland thing, and sort of the intent of Wendy's character, I could not agree more. I found a quote that Stephen King said. He said that he turned Wendy into one of the most misogynistic characters ever put on film. She's basically just there to scream and be stupid, and that's not the woman I wrote about. It got so bad, her hair started falling out.
Mm-hmm.
The mistreatment of this woman, unforgivable. I do not like. And the fact
that she was such, like, you could tell that, like, in between takes and in interviews and things like that, she seemed like such, like, a gentle, kind.
Yeah. It's heartbreaking. It really is heartbreaking.
It really is.
It seems like this man has a poor attitude. He seems very pompous, very arrogant. In an article that I read, it said that he, right after, what was the movie that he did right before it that was a flop?
Barry Lyndon, which
is. Yeah, Barry Lyndon.
If you hate this movie, I hate that movie equally. That movie is terrible.
I know nothing about it, but
yeah, it's bad.
According to a video that I saw that was about him, he right after that movie, he was looking for something else to read, and he got a bunch of supernatural horror stories and started reading them. And if he didn't like it, he tossed it and, like, he threw it up against the wall.
Yeah.
And like, Jesus,
he's grown.
And then, yeah. And then finally he settled on, unfortunately, The Shining and took it. So going back to what you said in take two, I read somewhere that according to one of Kubrick's biographers, Stephen King wrote an entire draft of the screenplay for The Shining. Like, he set one up and sent one to him, and Kubrick didn't even want to look at it. He didn't even think it was worthy of a glance. This man had the nerve to call Stephen King's writing weak. And he's one of the most prolific writers in history. But that
doesn't, and he's such a nice guy. Like, why would you?
I know, Stephen King, bless
him. He's like your grandpa.
Yeah,
he's probably like your dad back then. But
yeah, I adore that man. But it gets worse. There was an article that I read that Stephen King still tells this story at some of his book readings, that Stanley Kubrick would call him at 7 a.m. to like talk and ask him questions and have like philosophical discussions. And one of the quotes that I read said, Kubrick asks, "I think stories of the supernatural are fundamentally optimistic, don't you? If there are ghosts, then that means we survived death." And then King responded with a question, how did hell fit into that picture? And Kubrick just simply said, "Oh, I don't believe in hell." I can 100% appreciate the amount of dedication and the amount of hard work and academic research that went into this production, but I don't like the outcome. Like, I find this to be truly a very ugly painting. Like, if this were a work of art, I wouldn't want to look at this painting. I don't particularly like the artist. It's not something that I'm interested in. And throughout my research, I found that there were so many references pulled, varying from like H.P. Lovecraft to even like Freud. And I feel like if he wasn't so adamant about trying to make this like subliminal, deep, artistic masterpiece, something to, I don't want to say fool us, but maybe trick us or pull a fast one on his audience and focus more on telling like a compelling story, then this film would have hit every note for me. But instead, I was kind of left with these bland, flat characters. It was a predictable, really boring timeline and a very useless and unsatisfying ending. I think he strips so much away to be able to let the audience fill in the blanks with their own minds and with their own subliminal
theories.
Yeah, yeah. That he strips so much of that away that there was really no substance left. And that's not impossible. Like, that's not something that's impossible. I mean, look at the movies that we've already done. Look at The Shape of Water or Interstellar. And I know I want to do movies like Neon Demon or Mother or Annihilation eventually on this podcast. Those are like some of my favorites because they all have these very incredible stories that strike this like brilliant and stunning balance between keeping your attention and keeping you uncomfortable at the right moments while incorporating a deeper meaning into the whole production. That's my takeaway from this movie.
So I just have one question.
Mm-hmm.
I ordered you a Stanley Kubrick t-shirt. And it was like $40, and I sent it to your house. Like, can you still wear it though? Because it was expensive.
No. No, I will say that it definitely made me want to see. I'm conflicted because I very much want to watch 2001, A Space Odyssey. Very much. I don't want to support this man, but I really.
Well, he's dead, Jordan.
I know, but I still, through the research for this movie, I found a lot of clips from that. And there were actually a lot of clips in it in Room 237 that. They just seemed really cool. I feel like that's a better movie. It's not a book. It's not based off of anything. And it would give me a much clearer view into his work and how he works.
2001 isn't a book?
What?
I thought 2001 was a book.
Oh, well, okay. If it was a book, I haven't read it. So
2001, that's a big difference. A Space Odyssey. Let me see.
Actually, yeah, I feel like every one of his movies
was an adaptation. Yeah, there. I feel like that too. It is based off a book,
but I haven't read it yet, and I will not read it. So,
yeah, please don't stop reading books.
I won't. No, everyone, please read more books, please. But that's
like, are you not worried that this is going to happen with Dr. Sleep?
No, because it's not directed by Stanley Kubrick.
No, I guess so. At the end of the day, the problem is Stanley.
Honestly, I feel like this whole thing was a direction issue.
Well, he's gone now, Jordan, so yeah, everything's okay. The bad man's gone.
I don't wish death on anyone, but if he were alive, I would not respect this man, most likely. And prayers to Shelley Duvall. She's still alive. Like, wherever you are, Shelley, I hope you're doing good.
Probably is a listener.
That would make me so happy.
Well, so that was disappointing, guys. I love the movie. He has every right not to like it, I suppose. But at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter what we think. It only matters what God thinks. No, it matters, what God thinks and what you guys think, too, I suppose. So I really want to hear from you whether or not you liked it, if you've read the book, if you haven't read the book, if you don't know how to read.
I'll teach you.
But yeah, I mean, I don't know what else there is to say other than the fact that this is probably our biggest disagreement.
Yeah.
Oh, one last thing. Hold on. Did you know that Dick Halloran was in It? How did that get past me?
What? The remake?
No. Like, Dick Halloran is mentioned as being one of the people that was in I don't even know what it's called, but the place that blows up and it's like for black people. He was a cook at that place.
Oh,
and
my
he survived God. And is in The Shining.
Wait, so where was this referenced in It or The Shining?
So It mentions Dick Halloran in it.
Oh my God.
And I like never put that together. I mean, I've never read The Shining, but I've read It.
You just made my day. Give me one second.
Suddenly this movie is great and everything's changed.
No, that just means Stephen King is incredible. The Black Spot.
Yeah.
Oh my God. What a great way to lift my spirits after such a depressing, sad. That makes me happy. I'm such a huge Stephen King fan.
Just kidding. I made it up.
No, I just looked it up. You dweeb.
I don't know what to say.
I'm sorry. I want to extend apologies if I offended anyone or pissed anyone off.
Nobody's going to get offended by this.
I am simply offering another side, another way to look at this movie. Keep an open mind. I don't know.
No, that's not good. Actually, the way we'll end it is we'll both do our best Tony impersonation.
No.
Do it.
No, I don't want to.
Do your finger.
That.
Do your finger.
No, I don't want to.
They can't see you, but I can see you. And the FBI people can see you. Do your finger. Do it.
I don't know what to say.
Danny's not here, Mrs. Torrance.
I'm not going to do that.
Do it.
I don't want to.
Then you will lose by default.
That, fine.
No, come on. Do it. It'll be funny.
I yield.
Do it for our fucking fans.
No. No, I will not. You can't make me.
It's so stupid. I hate this.
Yeah, and I'm not even going to do it. I'm just going to... okay, bye, everybody. So something cool that I learned is that Robin Williams and Robert De Niro were both considered for the role of Jack.
This is a bad way to start this because I'd be like, no, because with Kubrick having the reins, I just don't trust him. I don't at all.
Well, there's more to this, but this game is going to be a lot of fun.
Directed by anyone else, I am totally a fan of both of those actors, and I think that they would do an amazing job.
I just think it's what the reason why they didn't get it is even better. Because De Niro, when Kubrick saw De Niro in Taxi Driver, he thought that De Niro wouldn't be able to go crazy enough. And then I also read that Williams wasn't cast because Kubrick thought he would be too crazy.
Oh my God.
I thought that was really funny. But regardless of whether or not you don't like the Kubrick, Jack Nicholson, Shelley Duvall movie, we're going to make our own because this is the recast game, but we're going to recast The Shining, which is appropriate because we always do like these random recasts of other movies.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, we've kind of done, I mean, say for Pulp Fiction, we've kind of done more recent movies. I feel like the point of recasting a movie is to sort of update it or bring it into a more contemporary age. I don't know. Let's go back and forth. So we decided to come up with the main four actors in this movie, which would be Jack, Wendy, Danny, and Dick Halloran. Yeah. And then come up with a fifth, a new director.
Oh, so Stanley Kubrick can't direct mine?
Correct.
Damn it.
I mean, he could, but it'd probably be shit again. So, I mean, if you want to...
Wow, oh wow. Get to your... Who do you want to go first?
Let's get the easy one out of the way. Danny. It's hard to look up, like, young child actors. Danny's, like, 5 years old.
So, I'll go first with this. I really didn't want to pick this. I wanted to be more original than this. But I was like, well, this is actually kind of perfect.
I feel like we probably picked the same one. But go ahead.
I picked Jackson Robert Scott.
Yep, me too.
Oh, my God, really?
Yes.
That's funny.
For those who don't know, he played Georgie Denbro in the recast of It. He wow. is so adorable.
Our minds and to be honest, place.
Yeah, I didn't really have a face to put on Danny when I was reading the book. So my mind kind of automatically went to him. So perfect. That was perfect.
He's like a great age and it looks like he's doing really good work in the Prodigy movie.
That's oh, supposed yeah.
to come out this year. So I'm like...
Good news. That's awesome.
I think he can do it. And like how great. Like Kathy Bates played Dolores Claiborne and Annie Wilkes. So
yeah.
Jackson Robert Scott could play Georgie and Danny.
Yep. I mean, clock's ticking because he's not going to be like five forever. So get on it, someone, please.
He'll probably only be five for like a year.
I know. Who did you pick for Dick Halloran?
Danny Glover.
That's a good one.
Yeah, I'm very talented and smart. He's in Lethal Weapon and Color Purple. And if you don't know who Danny Glover is, stop watching this podcast.
I know who Danny Glover is.
No, I was not talking to you.
I'm sorry. You will probably recognize this name. I don't know if the general public will, but do you know who Tony Todd is?
Yes.
Good. So he was, I feel like he's most recognizable in the Final Destination.
He's movies. Candyman.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't. Yeah, yeah.
I met him. Did I tell you that?
I was... No, you probably did, but I forgot.
I have a picture with him. He's really, really nice. I love Tony Todd. That's really good. That's actually, yeah, I could see both of them doing it. He's very warm. He's very creepy in pretty much everything he does because it's,
yeah.
Unfortunately, he sort of has been typecast.
Yeah.
I think he could do that really, do a very good job. So
let's do Wendy next.
Okay. So I picked Vera Farmiga.
Great choice.
And here's the thing. So I needed my Wendy to match with
your Jack.
My Jack. And yeah. I feel like they do match. But then I also remember you saying that like there is a compelling story to be told with a little bit more of a stronger Wendy.
Yeah.
And so I've only ever gotten like Shelley Duvall who you know, I like in the movie, but is definitely not playing a strong female character, no. You know?
He stomped that character into the dirt, which is quite unfortunate.
Okay, let's keep moving.
What I'm not going to do is very slyly introduce some people that I considered to maybe seem like I was cheating, because that's definitely not what happened. And I definitely don't have Jessica Chastain on the list, but what I went with, maybe this is terrible, but Jennifer Lawrence, but purely because of her performance in Mother. If you haven't seen Mother, I think it's a wonderful movie. She played an incredible, what's the word? Like dramatic, I don't want to say crazy, but like when she can break down very well, which yeah. is, I think.
Yeah, no, I think they would both be pretty decent for it. Both of your yeah. choices. I knew you would cheat. I knew it.
I'm not cheating. I didn't mention. I will say I have about like eight names. A lot of them are crossed off, but Vera Farmiga was one of them. So
you have eight names.
Yeah, a lot. And it may or may not have included like Toni Collette or like Winona Ryder or a bunch of other actresses like Elizabeth.
Holmes. It's so weird because like with the Wendy character, again, apparently she's not like, you know, the character in the book. So I really didn't know exactly how to go with that.
Yeah.
But again, like, I just love her, and I think she obviously can play somebody who is going through some tumultuous stuff with the Conjuring movies. I mean, she acts her ass off in those.
Yeah, and this was something I probably should have brought up in take three, but the Kubrick version of Wendy was so interesting because she was sort of like this wet rag, but also did all of the maintenance and the work in the hotel. She's the only one shown that
Jack was doing was writing.
Was writing and fucking around. Like, she's this really important character that just gets kicked to the wind. Anyway, let's do your Jack. Who are you pairing with Vera Farmiga?
So I picked Michael Fassbender. I think that he can do intense very well, and he can also be
like a warm and kind, gentle and father.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like a family man. Mm-hmm. It just fit. And then I thought that Vera Farmiga and him, like, believably
could be look like they could I'd be. See that.
They're about the same age. Like,
yeah, I can see that for sure. My Jack. There were some honorable mentions, like Leonardo DiCaprio and Wes Bentley. But my final decision, I don't know if this is weird or not, but I went on a limb and put Michael C. Hall. For those of you who don't know who that is, if you're familiar with the show Dexter or Six Feet Under, like, he can play a warm father and a crazy psycho.
Yeah, it's funny, though, because, like, it's not that kind of role where it's like, oh, that actor does that all the time. Because if you actually watch Dexter, he's not like a maniac in that.
He's not a psycho.
I think he can do it, like, but he is normally very calm and very collected. He plays, right. You know, even when he's killing people, he's pretty cool about it. But, like, I know that he can be.
Yeah, he also has a huge range. And I've seen a few episodes of Six Feet Under, and I know he can, like, I'm positive he could do it. And I also just want to see him in more things. So that was my choice.
He was dating his sister.
Say that again?
He was dating his sister on that show.
Oh, on the show? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, now director. Who's your director? Who would you think would direct?
Robert Eggers. He directed The Witch.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, like, that's all that when it comes to The Shining, at its core, that's what it means to me. It's just, like, this really sort of disturbing, eerie, beautifully shot, wonderful horror movie.
Yeah.
And that has parts that are genuinely scary, and The Witch has that. He has one movie to his name, though, but I mean, I feel like that's a hell of a resume.
Yeah, no, that was a great movie. If you haven't seen it, watch it. There will probably be an episode on it in the future. I chose Jordan Peele to be the director of my fantasy Shining movie.
I got five on.
Oh my God. Just okay. Right now, he has out one movie and one trailer, and he's already one of my favorite directors of all time. He's going to change the industry. He already has, to be honest. I think he just seems perfect for this. He can create a good dynamic family, and he can create psychopaths. Like, I don't think there's a better choice. I would love to see a Shining remade by Jordan Peele for sure. If you have not seen the trailer for Us, go do it. Turn the volume up as loud as you can and just get as close to the TV as you can or computer and just...
Yeah. He made me sit down and have my volume up to 100 on my television midnight. We sat on the floor right in front of my television.
He's not kidding either. I really did
that.
This,
that was, like, legit. Yeah. Well, that was good. That was fun. I like our Shining movies.
Definitely.
Get on the phone. Start booking these performances.
I'll call my people.
Oh, is that it?
Isn't it? I have nothing else to say.
You sure you don't have more picks?
Oh, I could tell you all of...
I have 16 choices for Danny.
I really do. But hey, I was nice and I crossed off. I narrowed it down to 3. So if you've made it past my bitterness toward this movie, I applaud you and want to let you know I'm not always this sour. So if I haven't completely scared you away and you'd like to listen to more, you can find us at Take 3 AMP, that's Take3AMP.com, or Take 3 AMP on all major social media sites. This episode was produced and edited by Jordan Sato and Nicholas Crawford, and we would also really love it if you guys left us a review on iTunes. It really, really does help us. Otherwise, we'll see you next time.